ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, fifth canto, and we're on the 11th chapter. Judd Bharat instructs King Rahugana. We'll be starting up at text number 7. Great to see you all. Hare Krishna. Thanks for moving heaven and earth to come here just to hear the Bhagavatam. That's the primary means of advancing in spiritual life, Shravanam Kirtanam, and putting oneself in a position to hear is the way that one can simply advance. You just have to be there and stay there for as long as possible. The vibration is punya shravana kirtana. In and of itself, it has its own power, its own effect on our lives. Even if we don't know it, even if we don't believe it, it still does. So, thanks for being here, and for everyone who's joined us online from various places. Hare Krishna. So up to this point, we're following the journey of Bharat Maharaj, who is one of the sons of Rishabhadeva. Rishabhadeva had 100 sons, out of which some became great rishis, like Kavi, Havir, Antariksha, Prabhuda, Pipalayana, Avirhotra, Drumila, Chamasa, Karabhajana, the Navayogendras, who later on will find the 11th canto meet up with Maharaj Nimi. And this comprises a good section of the 11th canto. Maharaj Nimi asks them questions. Highly elevated personalities, so much so that they just wandered everywhere in the universe. They happened to come to the place where Maharaj Nimi was performing a fire sacrifice. And when the priests and all the attendees at the sacrifice saw the Navayogendras, they stood up. But you know who else stood up? Even the fire. It's mentioned in the Bhagavatam. Out of great respect for these great sages, they stood up. These were 9 of the sons of Rishabhadeva. Some also became brahminical priests. Some took charge of managing various parts of the universe. But out of all the 100 sons, Bharat was the best. According to Rishabhadeva, all his other sons should follow Bharat, because he was the most advanced. He became a king, and he ruled for many years, and then he took sannyas. He left home with the sole idea of attaining perfection in life, and went off to the forest, and was performing his means of worshiping the Lord. He had mantras that he was saying. He was reciting the Gayatri Mantra as a means to worship the Lord Narayan within the sun. And another verse he was chanting, Om Deya Sada Savriti Mandala Madhyavarti Narayana Sasijasana Sanavishtaha Keyuravan Makara Kundalavan Kiriti Hiran Vapur Hiran Maya Vapur Drichashanka Chakraha Deyam sada paribhavagnam abhishtadoham. So he was repeating this mantra, and this describes how the Lord is there within the sun. Actually, the Sri Upanishad says, tadejati tanaijati tadure tadvantike tarantarasya sarvasya taru sarvasya sibayataha. The Lord is far away, but he is very near as well. So he's far away, but very near as well. That's an interesting statement to think about. Because sometimes people think, oh, God's so far away from me. But actually, he's the closest one to me. He's right within our hearts. And he is available to us in so many different ways. In the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about the ways in which we can see his vibhutis, his particular opulences within the material nature, and to recognize him there. In the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also talks about how one can remember him as being the larger than the largest, smaller than the smallest, one who's always a person, who's effulgent, and so many different ways. So he's very close. But there's a way in which, because I become distracted, I forget about him. So Bharat Maharaj had a specific determination to remember Krishna, and he had a specific practice. He was bathing in the sacred river 3 times a day, and regulating his mind and senses very carefully. And he had become very advanced. He was on the stage of bhava, where he was feeling emotion in his heart for the Lord, and tears would come to his eyes. And then one day he saw a deer, and the deer was frightened by the roar of a lion. And then the deer jumped across the stream. And as she jumped, she was carrying a deer within her abdomen and within her womb, and she miscarried. And this little fawn came out, fell into the water, and the deer went into a nearby cave and died out of shock by the whole experience. So then Bharat Maharaj saw the deer, and he felt bad for the little baby, and so he picked it up and brought it back to his ashram and began to nurture it and feed it grass, pet it, ward off any predators, and soon he became attached. And the deer was attached to him also. And then, proportionately, he forgot about his spiritual practice. He gradually stopped chanting his mantras. His meditation became a farce. He was pretending he was meditating, but actually he was looking around to see where the deer was. And sometimes while he was meditating, the deer would come with its little teeth and chew on the kusha grass mat that he was sitting on. And sometimes with its little horns that were starting to come out, the little deer would butt up against him while he was meditating. And this gave him great pleasure. But he wasn't meditating. He was thinking of the deer. And then he became more and more absorbed in the deer. And at the time of death, he thought of the deer. And in his next life, he took birth as a deer. Because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, what does he say about this? Samriddhi? Very good. Do you know the verse? It starts with something, two words that you say when you get really nice prasadam. What do you say when you get the best prasadam you've ever had? Yum yum. Yang yang vapi smaran bhavam tajat yante kalevaram tam tam evaiti konteya sadatad bhava bhavitaha. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, whatever your mind goes to at the time of death. And Prabhupada says in a purport that whatever subject matter attracts the dying man, that will determine the next life. That's the bhava, the overall feeling. What are you most attracted to? What subject matter? If I could tell when you're dreaming, when you don't have control over your mind, where does your mind go? Does it go to Rancho Cucamonga? Or does it go to Goloka, Vrindavan? When one practices in a way in which one's thinking of Krishna in the daytime, in the waking state, then one will also be able to remember Krishna even while one's sleeping. And Prabhupada gave an example that he once saw that there was a cloth merchant who all day long was quoting prices. He was selling cloth wholesale, so wholesalers were coming in. He was saying the price, 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 price all day long. And then he'd take a nap on the floor of the shop. And then while he was sleeping, he'd still be quoting prices. So Prabhupada gave that as an example, that whatever we're absorbed in our waking state will also carry over into our dreaming state. And similarly, at the time of death, we won't have much control over what we think of, because we lose our ability to control the mind, but whatever our prevalent feeling is will rise up. And so that happened to Bharat. He was so absorbed in thinking of the deer, that was his feeling when he was leaving the world. He was attached to the deer, thinking of the deer. So he took a dear body. But Krishna takes everything into consideration. He understood that this was a mistake. He also gave Bharat in his next life the credit of remembering everything that he had done in his previous life. So even as a deer, the little deer remembered that, oh, I'm Bharat. I forgot. I made a big mistake, and now I've taken birth as a deer. So as a deer, he left his family, and he went off back to the ashram where he had practiced before. And he began his practice once again of Ashtanga yoga, little deer bathing three times a day, and practicing the best he could in the deer body. He only ate some leaves, very austere. And in his next life, he took birth as Judd Bharat. And Judd Bharat now was a fully realized personality. And this just goes to show that we may have slip-ups in our practice of devotional service. But as Prabhupada used to say, failure becomes the pillar to success. Because oftentimes, I'll perform devotional service and I'll do it out of momentum. I'll think, oh, I've done this before, I can do it again, and I may do it in an unfeeling way. I may just, by rote, repeat the mantras and not be fully conscious or aware, what to speak of, putting my emotions into the practice. But if something unforeseen happens, if I make a mistake, if I slip somehow, I may then become more intense because I'll realize what I've lost. You don't know what you got till it's gone. Have you ever heard that? You don't know what you got till it's gone. I take so many things for granted. Whatever I have, including this body. Body's such a fine instrument for realizing the truth, for making progress. It's actually the first opportunity out of 8,400,000 species of life to come to the human form of life to have this great opportunity. But then I take it for granted. And all the other assets that Krishna gives me, I may take for granted also. Association of devotees, what else might I take for granted? Yes?
Sunlight.
Sunlight. I take the sun for granted all the time. It comes up, goes back down again, and I don't even notice, but it's the biggest event of the day. That's why those who are advanced practice chanting the Gayatri Mantra, in which they worship the sun. They see the sun's coming up. There's God. Of course, we know at this time of year it becomes very depressing. Some people get this special affliction. I forget what it's called, but because of the darkness at this time, there's a few less hours of light, and people become very depressed at this time of year. What to speak of every night, living entities just go to sleep. They give up when it gets dark because Krishna's not there anymore, and just forget it. So, how many other things do we take for granted? Yeah, the body working condition. I just take it for granted. I'm going to eat 5 idlis and it'll all be taken care of. All the nutrients will be distributed. I didn't even think about it. I just take it for granted, right? But if suddenly you can't digest, it becomes a serious situation. What else? Time. Take time for granted until it's the last minute. And then I realize, oh boy, I should have been more on top of it. Traveling's good for that, because you have to leave the house, leave everything behind, pick what you're going to take. And once the cab's there, it's too late. You forgot something, and you just forgot it. That's it. And time is something that's the most valuable, but I can take it for granted. What else? What is it? Life itself. The very fact that I'm conscious. I feel happy that you woke up, but I could take it for granted. Wake up, oh no, I have so many things to do. So, and I could take that for granted, right? What else? Somebody was saying
relationships.
I can take for granted. You may have the best spouse in the world, but you think like, why are they always nagging me? You know, why don't they leave me alone? Right? Yeah. What else? You take Bhagavad Gita for granted. You meet people all the time, especially from India, because they've grown up with Bhagavad Gita. They'll say, here, Bhagavad Gita. Ah, Bhagavad Gita. I'm knowing. It says, do your work. I know Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada said, sometimes people live by the Ganga, and then they go elsewhere to take a bath. He said, it's just the Ganga. So it's easy to take everything for granted, but when something unforeseen happens, it takes away our opportunities. We slip into a position of less fortune than we had before. Disadvantage. That intense desire can come springing back. And it is by this only that we advance in devotional service. Not the slipping, but the intense desire. As given by the Padyavali, Krishna bhakti rasa bhavito mati kriyatam yadi kritopi labhyate tataloyam apimulyam ekalam janmakoti sukritirna labhyate. Who knows that verse? So what it says is the only price to pay for Krishna bhakti is greed. You have to have intense greed. You really want to have it. You really want to have that in order to get Krishna. If you're just kind of lukewarm, like there's different stages of boiling. Well, first the water is cool, and then it becomes warm, and then with just starting to boil, it has tiny little bubbles. You can barely tell. And then when it picks up a little more, you're a cook, right? The bubbles come more and more. When it's really boiling, you can tell from across the room. You can hear it. It's spluttering, and huge bubbles are coming up. It's roiling. So this verse says that if you want Krishna bhakti, you have to have that boiling desire to have Krishna bhakti, to be engaged in service. And sometimes Krishna takes away what we have just so we can not take it for granted. That's why Queen Kunti prayed, Vipara santuta sasvat tatra tatra chagat goro bhavato darshanam yatsyad apunar bhavadarshanam. She said, please send difficulties my way. Who prays like that in the morning when you wake up? My Lord, where are the catastrophes? They've all gone away. Please let them come back. That's Queen Kunti prays like that because it's an acquired taste, just like bitter melon. People say, why do you want to eat something bitter? Because once you eat the bitter melon, then your whole body becomes awakened to all these other flavors. The appetite wakes up, which is the main focus of Ayurveda, right? The appetite has to be there. And unless you have an intense desire to hear, Kapila Dev says, he gives this as the way in which one can tell how advanced one's becoming in devotional service, and that is, how much do you desire to hear? How intense is your desire to hear? Do you have to hear, or is it just by some regulation, or can you do without it? I can do something else. There are games I can play that I'd rather do than hearing. So at different levels, we can understand how advanced we're becoming by the intensity of our desire. So what is the most intense desire? It's compared to greed. When somebody becomes so greedy, they do crazy things just to get what they're after. And then the verse goes on to say that you can't get Krishna bhakti by doing ordinary pious work, even if you do it for thousands or millions of births. Janma koti sukritirna labhyate. You can perform all kinds of pious work, good stuff, really good stuff, great stuff, in fact, but it won't get you Krishna bhakti. There's only one element, one feature that gives you Krishna bhakti, and that's your intense desire to have it. And if you can get that by association, if you can get that by introspection and realizing how fortunate I am to have been given an opportunity, and you can cultivate that, that's how one chants good japa. You have to have that feeling, intense feeling. Not I'm satisfied, or I have enough. But one has to feel bereft. Queen Kunti says, Janmaishvarya Shruta Shribir Edamana Madapunan Naivarhat Yabidatumvai Tomakinchana Gochara. If you want to pray with sincere feeling, and that, after all, that's what japa is, then you have to feel that I'm bereft, I don't have anything. I'm a kinchana. I don't even have one thing. And she names all the ways in which I can think I have something. Because I was born in a high family. I'm opulent. Because I have a fancy car. I'm very learned. Because I went to a fancy school. She said, I'm beautiful. All these things are ways in which I can think I have something. But if someone thinks I don't have anything, then he becomes qualified to pray sincerely. One thing I'm wondering if we have in here is air. Do we have enough air? Who said no?
Do you need air?
Do you? I got nothing against air. It's one of my favorite things in life, actually. And I don't even know it's... I don't think about it until it's gone. When I don't have air, that's when I start thinking, I really appreciate air. Whatever way you think air is available. It's better to be like on the edge of cold than it is... cozy warm when you're... So, I'm just relating to Bharat Maharaj and how he must have felt. I mean, this is... Prabhupada once said about... This doesn't apply to Bharat Maharaj, but it applies to the precarious situation that we're in. And that is that we, at every moment, are on a precipice and we can fall off. We're on a human form, in the human form of life, but as great poet Jayadeva said, Kamala Dala Jala Jivana Talamala. It's just like those little beads of water on a lotus leaf. You watch them and they don't stick there. And if the wind blows the leaf a little bit, it just rolls off. So my life's like that. And any time I can go. And there's no guarantee. So once on a morning walk, Prabhupada said, people are going through their life, and they don't consider what their next destination is. So he said, a man goes to sleep. He said, death is like sleeping. So he said, a man goes to sleep as a man, but he wakes up as a dog. This is transmigration. When I heard that, I was very frightened. Because I read Franz Kafka, was that his name? He wrote that book about the man who woke up as a centipede or a cockroach. Metamorphosis, yeah. I think I read it in fifth grade. Franz Kafka. Yeah, he had the full consciousness that somehow he was transformed into a cockroach or a centipede. Centipede, okay. So then Prabhupada said, go to sleep as a man, wake up as a dog. I mean, what if that's... what I've been going through, transmigration. I think I'm a human. I live in, what is that place? Rancho Cucamonga. I'm fine. I have a family. I have a house. This is who I am. But once you slip off that platform at the time of death, then you go wherever you're asked to go. You have to go. This is Daivanetrina. You're forced. You don't get any more say in it. There's no petition, there's no appeal, doesn't matter how much money you have, you're just asked to go to that place. So, go to sleep as a man, wake up as a dog. And what a situation for a pure devotee like Bharat Maharaj to have slipped into this mistaken relationship with a deer and then to wake up in a deer's body and fully realize he is there. I'm just trying to relate to that. Because it's also mentioned by Kapiladev that fortunate souls, when they're in the womb, they become conscious at a certain point. Around 7 months, they become very conscious of the way they're encased in a womb, They realize that I'm a soul, but I'm within this tiny little body. And they begin to pray to the Lord and say that I've been transmigrating from one birth to the next, and now I've come into this situation again, and I know what's going to happen. As soon as I'm forced to leave the womb, my senses will become externalized, and I'll forget everything again. And I'll enter back into this cycle of suffering in the samsara from one birth to the next. And he says, better I stay in this situation, even though he's suffering within the womb, because at least now I'm conscious. So this is the kind of acute awareness that is required for one to have some impetus to practice devotional service very intensely. So Bart Marsh got that from his movement from a king's body into the body of a little deer. And so when he came out as Bharat, as Judd Bharat, in a Brahmin family, he was fully aware what his duty in life was, and he wanted no mixing with the external energy. He pretended as if to be retarded, so that his family would disregard him and not try to engage him. And so Judd Bharat then lived in the family, had 9 siblings. After his father left, who was his well-wisher, who tried to help him, and he ignored the help. The other siblings treated him as a non-entity. They would feed him the worst kind of food, whatever was left over, thrown out, wasn't fit to be eaten by pigs, they'd give it to him, and he'd eat it like it was nectar. He didn't care, because he had nothing to do with this world. Nor do we. Asango Khyayam Purusha, we don't have any real business here. We don't have any real association with the material world. I just project myself into it and imagine that I do, and therefore I suffer. I saw an experiment the other day where they put somebody on a table, and then they had a rubber arm, and then they put the person's arm behind a screen. You saw this? And I got to get that because I want to show it in a class. But there's a way in which they would have somebody who was pulling a paintbrush, like a little brush over their finger behind the screen, and that on the same, on the rubber arm that the subject could see, they were stimulating the same finger. And then they touch the rubber finger here, and then they touch the real finger here. So after a little while, the person began to identify with the rubber arm, thinking that's my actual arm. And then they bring out a pin and stick it in the rubber arm. And the person would jump. And then they bring out a wrench and they smash the hand. And the person like jump out of their seat, even though they weren't being harmed at all. And I was recognizing the verse, this as relating to the verse in the Bhagavatam, Bhayam Dvitiya Binibeshita Syad, that when one identifies oneself as something that he or she is not, then fear arises. So Judd Bharat was completely freed from that misconception. So he wanted no relationship with the material world at all. And even so far as when he was left out in the field at night by his siblings to guard the crops, he was picked up by some very low-minded people who thought that they would take him and sacrifice him to Kali. Of course, when they got there, Kali jumped out of the deity and killed all the sacrificers because she recognized here as a pure devotee of the Lord. But later on, he was wandering and King Rahugana came by on his palanquin, but they were missing one of the palanquin carriers, so they were looking to recruit somebody. So the other palanquin carriers came out and they saw Judd Bharat, who was very strongly built. And they said, you, come over here. You help carry this palanquin. So he just complied, and he picked up the palanquin, and he was walking along. But when he saw ants on the road, he would avoid them. And that meant that the palanquin would jostle the king. So the king, what are you doing? Carry it right, he was telling his palanquin carriers. He said, it's not us, it's the new guy. He looked out from the corner of his palanquin and said, what's wrong? Are you too skinny to carry this? He obviously wasn't skinny. This king was being sarcastic. There's something wrong with you? Are you a fool? He was berating him again and again. And finally, Jed Bharat broke his silence. He hadn't spoken to anybody. Now he spoke to the king. He said, I'm neither skinny nor fat because I'm not my body. And nor am I disturbed by your words because you're mistaking me to be this body, but it's not me. The king was surprised. He said, no, you've called me a fool, but I'm neither intelligent or fool. I'm simply a self-realized person. I know I have nothing to do with this world. Now the king gets off his palanquin and he offers obeisances on the ground. And he said, I'm not afraid of the thunderbolt of Indra. I'm not afraid of the trident of Lord Shiva, but I am afraid of offending a Brahmana. And then he said, please instruct me. Tell me, what is the purpose of life? And he began to ask questions. And some of the questions he asked are very practical. Because he said, although you say you're neither skinny or fat, you have nothing to do with this world, still, I'm a king, I have to do my duty. There's so many things that I'm forced to do in this world, and it really seems like that's me, and that's what's important to do. And Jed Bharat is just beginning to answer these questions, very practical questions. Very similar to what Devahuti asked to Kapiladev, because although Kapiladev spoke about self-realization, Devahuti said, yes, but it sounds really good philosophically, but it still seems like I'm my body. And it seems impossible to separate the mind from the material energy. So what do I do? So these are very practical questions that we can all relate to, because one way or another we find ourselves in a material body and interacting with the world in various ways, and therefore how to get out of it, that's what's explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam, practical for everybody. So with that, let's read a few verses. Everybody okay? All right. Text 7. The mind makes the living entity within this material world wander through different species of life, and thus the living entity experiences mundane affairs in different forms as a human being, demigod, fat person, skinny person, and so forth. Learned scholars say that bodily appearance, bondage, and liberation are caused by the mind. Purport. Just as the mind is the cause of bondage, it can also be the cause of liberation. The mind is described here as para avara. What's it described as? Para means transcendental, and avara means material. What does para mean? Somebody? And what does avara mean?
Material.
Correct. When the mind is engaged in the Lord's service, Savaimana Krishna Padara Vindayo, it is called para, transcendental. When the mind is engaged in material sense gratification, it is called avara, or material. At the present moment, in our conditioned state, our mind is fully absorbed in material sense gratification. But it can be purified and brought to its original Krishna consciousness by the process of devotional service. We have often given the example of Ambarish Maharaj. Savai mana Krishna padara vindayo vachamsi vaikunta gunar navarnane. Who was Maharaj Ambarish? What's he famous for? Do you know? Ambarish Maharaj? Okay. Other way around. Someone offended him. Durvasa Muni offended Ambarish Maharaj, right? What else is he famous for? Yeah, he has a king. He was a king, so he had unlimited resources. And so sometimes when people have unlimited resources, they spend it for unlimited ways to enjoy their senses. Like they'll buy 50 cars, or they'll, I don't know, there's lots of ways they can do it. But he spent all his resources on engaging Krishna's service, and he did every kind of devotional service. He did the Shravanam Kirtan, he heard about the Lord, he engaged his mind in that way. He also cleaned the temple of the Lord, engaged his hands, He engaged his feet in walking to the temple. You ever walk to the temple? That's devotional service. You know, I met a devotee in Tokyo. I was just in Tokyo. And he became famous because he lives about 15 miles from the temple in Tokyo. But he walks to the temple. Not only does he walk there, he walks back. And people come along, do you want to ride? And he goes, no thanks. This is my parikram. Walks all the way through Tokyo. And I was thinking how amazing that is, that just because he has this devotion, he has this feeling that the Lord's there, I'm going to walk to see him. And he walks all the way through Tokyo, 15 miles. And now he's become famous. Everyone was telling me, I went to his house for a program, so everyone was telling me, you've got to meet this devotee. I said, so what's his thing? He walks to the temple. And then when he's at the temple, he said, okay, that's good, now you can take a ride home. So, no, I'm walking home. He's like, he walks home too. Every activity of devotional service, even if it's a simple thing like walking, it's so pleasing to Krishna. If you do it with devotion, then you become famous. Not that he's looking to become famous. He didn't think of it like that. But it just shows how exalted devotional service is, even simple ways. So Maharaj Ambarish became famous because he did every kind of devotional service all the time, kept his senses constantly engaged. So that's why Prabhupada quotes this verse constantly, Savai Manat Krishna Padara Vindayo. So he's continuing in the purport. The mind must be controlled in Krishna consciousness. Repeat that.
The mind must be controlled in Krishna consciousness.
The tongue can be utilized to spread the message of Krishna and glorify the Lord, or take prasad, the remnants of food offered to Krishna. Sevan mukhihi jivadau. When one utilizes the tongue in the service of the Lord, the other senses can become purified. As stated in the Narada Pancharatra, Sarvapati Vanir Muktam Tatpratvena Nirmalam. When the mind and senses are purified, one's total existence is purified. And one's designations are also purified. One no longer considers himself a human being, a demigod, cat, dog, Hindu, Muslim, and so forth. When the senses and mind are purified and one is fully engaged in Krishna's service, one can be liberated and return home back to Godhead. Text number 8. Who's speaking? Everyone agree? Okay. When the living entity's mind becomes absorbed in the sense gratification of the material world, it brings about his conditioned life and suffering within the material situation. However, when the mind becomes unattached to material enjoyment, it becomes the cause of liberation. When the flame in a lamp burns the wick improperly, the lamp is blackened. But when the lamp is filled with ghee and is burning properly, there is bright illumination. Similarly, when the mind is absorbed in material sense gratification, it causes suffering. And when detached from material sense gratification, it brings about the original brightness of Krishna consciousness. Purport. It is therefore concluded that the mind is the cause of material existence and liberation also. Everyone is suffering in this material world because of the... Three agree. Because of the... Correct. So if someone asked you today, why is everyone suffering in the material world, what could you tell them? Why are they suffering? Because of the mind. That's profound, isn't it? It's good to know what the cause of suffering is, because otherwise, if one can't diagnose a disease, there's little you can do about it. But here, by a self-realized soul, we're getting the diagnosis of why I suffer in the material world. The cause is? That's correct. That is correct. Everyone is suffering in this material world because of the mind. It is therefore proper to train the mind or to cleanse the mind from material attachment and engage it fully in the Lord's service. This is called spiritual engagement. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Mam chayo vyabhicharina. I'll say the first line and then you all say the second. Mam chayo vyabhicharina. No, you say the second line. Mam chayo vyabhicharina. Sagunan samati tyaitan. Very good. One who engages in full devotional service, who does not fall down in any circumstance, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the level of Brahman. We should engage the mind fully in Krishna conscious activities, then it will be the cause of our liberation for our returning home back to Godhead. However, if we keep the mind engaged in material activities for sense gratification, it will cause continuous bondage and will make us remain in this material world in different bodies, suffering the consequences of our different actions. This is a point I just want to touch on briefly, but the word consequences. Who's got the dictionary? Quick, look it up. Try to look it up in a good dictionary in your... the word consequences. So, human life is meant for considering consequences. Animals live, but they don't consider consequences so much. Well, they do to some point. I mean, I've seen dogs, a lot of them recently, when we were in Vrindavan, speeding along in a car, and the dog starts to walk across the road, and then he looks and sees, and then he changes his mind, turns around. What's that? Oh, that dog, yeah. That dog was spontaneously engaged in devotional service. But I see dogs that consider crossing the road and they change their mind. But long-term consequences, they may not be aware of. Human beings can be aware of long-term consequences. This is what it means to be a responsible human being. What does the word mean, by the way?
It's a noun. The meaning is the effect, result, or outcome of something.
Fact, result, or outcome.
Of something occurring earlier.
Of something occurring earlier. The accident was the consequence of reckless driving. And where does it come from? Latin. Good. And what was the original word in Latin? Consequentiare. Huh? Consequent? Consequere? And what did it mean? Consequent. Following cause. Huh?
Following closely.
That's interesting. Even Chanakya Pandit said, you have your karma, and it knows just how to find you. And he gave the example of a huge herd of cows, and they separate the calves for some time, and then they let them go. This is at the Goshal, as you can see, little calves over here, and You let him go, and he just runs right to his mother. There'll be 20 cows lined up, but he goes zip right in, finds his mother. It could be 100 cows, he'll still find his mother. 1,000. So similarly, karma follows us closely, knows just where to find us. You can go anywhere, but it's like, there you are. So consequence is very important. And this is one of the great lessons of this whole story, is consider the consequences. So this is one of the ways in which to remain present practically in one's life and stay engaged in Krishna consciousness. Remember that life is short and temporary, but there are consequences for everything that I do. And the Sri Upanishad says, Anyad ebohur sambhavad, anyad ahur sambhavad. The consequence of practicing devotional service is way different. It's not even slightly the same. It's completely different, it says, than the consequence that comes about by engaging materialistic activities. And I may think that what I'm doing right now is not consequential. It doesn't have that much to do with my future, but it has everything to do with my future. Whatever I'm doing now, even on a subtle level, even the small things, have an inordinate or compounded effect on my life. They add up to my final consciousness when I leave this world. And so one can actually be vigilant about this. This is what it means to be a strict devotee. To be careful about where one allows one's consciousness to go. And in practical terms, Prabhupada mentioned speech. Be careful what you say. Be careful what you eat. It makes a difference. Be careful how you interact with others. Engage in activities that are beneficial to the soul. And don't do mindless activities that simply engage one's mind and allow it to become more attached to sense gratification. Because there will be consequences for that in the end. So as I'm moving throughout my life, throughout my day, it's good to remember the consequential result of my activities, whatever they may be. Text number 9. Everyone okay?
Yes.
Say yes.
Yes.
But do it more enthusiastically.
Yes.
There are 5 working senses and 5 knowledge acquiring senses. Think about where they are. Do you know where they are? Like the legs are working senses. They're senses. But they work for you. It's very important. You don't have your legs, it's difficult to get around. Arms, legs, there are various working senses, and then there are senses that acquire knowledge. There is also the false ego. In this way, there are 11 items for the mind's functions. O hero, the objects of the senses, such as sound and touch, the organic activities, such as evacuation, and the different types of bodies, society, friendship, and personality, are considered by learned scholars the fields of activity for the functions of the mind. Purport, the mind is the controller of the 5 knowledge-acquiring senses and the 5 working senses. Each sense has its particular field of activity. In all cases, the mind is the controller and owner. By the false ego, one thinks oneself the body and thinks in terms of my body, my house, my family, my society, my nation. Shall I repeat that? My body, my house, my family, my society, my nation, and so on. Thus, these false identifications are due to the expansions of the false ego. Thus, one thinks that he is this or that. Thus, the living entity becomes entangled in material existence. Now I'll take a few reflections or questions. Anything you heard so far that you found interesting or useful, or any question that you may have? Dita Prashanta. Here, we got a microphone.
Also takes into consideration contributions that economy makes and evidence. You also mentioned that the price to achieve pure devotion service is volume, intense greed. So thank you for sharing that. And how sometimes Krishna takes things away just so that we don't take them for granted.
Yeah. So in the Sri Upanishad, it is said, Vayura Nilamamratam Atedam Pashmantam Shariram Om Krato Smarakritam Smara Krato Smarakritam Smara. Let this temporary body be burned to ashes, and let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. Now, O my Lord, please remember all my sacrifices. And because you are the ultimate beneficiary, please remember all that I have done for you. And in this purport, Prabhupada says, the devotee doesn't have to remind the Lord of what he's done for him. He knows perfectly well. He says, at the time of death, if the devotee happens to forget Krishna, then Krishna helps to remind the devotee. Now, I was thinking about that, because what about Bharat Maharaj? Now, he may remind you, but he may not remind you in a way that you really can appreciate. I mean, you'll appreciate it ultimately, but look at Bharat Maharaj. He was reminded, but he still had to take birth in the body of a deer. Consequences. So, a Krishna... it's better to, as they say, it's better to stay in shape than try to get in shape. Or it's easier to stay in shape than it is to get in shape. And similarly, it's easier just to remain in Krishna consciousness, maintain oneself in Krishna consciousness at a high level, than it is to try to make comebacks here and there. Although even those can be beneficial and they can become the pillars to success and so forth. Also, you mentioned, what were the other points?
Lalium.
Yeah, lalium and one other.
Krishna dates
other things. Yeah, this is a statement in the Mahabharata. Yasyaham ena grinnami harishe tadhanam shadai. So Krishna says that when I really show my favor, I take away all a person's wealth. And then they're left feeling helpless. How do you feel when you're helpless? When you feel helpless?
Pretty bad.
And what do you do? What's the next thing you do when you feel helpless?
Panic.
Yeah, panic. There's so many emotions we can feel. When one feels utterly helpless, I mean, there's an old saying, and I may have to explain it if you don't know what it is, but there are no atheists in foxholes. Raise your hand if you don't know what that means. Raise your hand if you know what it means. Okay, either way. So in the military, in the infantry during a war, there's a system where when the infantry soldiers are fighting on an open field, when they try to find some cover, they are taught how to dig a hole really quickly and then lie below the line of fire that's coming above their head. And it's such a dangerous situation because the hole's not likely that deep and bullets are flying over your head. And in that situation, you're fully aware that at any second, the trajectory can change and it'll be killed. So that's why it said, once somebody may say, I'm an atheist, but then when that starts happening, then they go, okay, I believe in God, I believe in God, God, please help me. So that, therefore, the saying, there are no atheists in foxholes. I went to Mexico recently, and I extended the saying. I said, there's no atheists in foxholes or in Mexico. So just having, when Krishna takes away things and makes us feel helpless, there's a way in which we may turn more intensely to him and take shelter. And it's in those moments that we may have a full cognizance of my actual situation, not the one that's being mentioned here that, oh, I have so many things to protect me. I have so many things I can fall back on, the mind thinks. And Sugadeva Goswami says early in the Bhagavatam that these are all what he calls fallible soldiers. He says, you take shelter of so many things, but they won't help you ultimately. The only person who can help you is Krishna. Yes? This is something Narada Muni mentions in the seventh canto when he talks about Varnashrama, and particularly he addresses each one of the ashrams, and he says with grihasthas have to do their duty. He said, externally, one must give all affection and protection to the family. Internally, one should cultivate a clear understanding that ultimately have no real relationship. Just as our friend here, Anyakashipu, said, that when travelers on the road come together in a little, they have a little place where they serve out sarsaparilla. That's root beer. People get together and have a root beer together. And they all sit around the table and they get to know each other, kind of friendly, and say, hi, how are you? How are you? Yeah, you got friends. Oh, I got friends. Oh, yahoo. You know, they have this way of bonding together. And then at the end, they pay their check for their root beer and they get up and they walk out. And they get in different cars and they go in different directions. I see this on the airplane all the time, too. People sit down, somebody strikes up a conversation, and then blah, 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 blah. For, you know, like 6 hours, they're talking like, oh, you did that? Well, here's what I did. And then they get off the airplane, they go to baggage claim, and they're gone. They never see each other again. So Hiranyakashipu said, so that's your family life. You think these are all your eternal parts and parcels, but they're not. They're actually coming together just for a short amount of time. They can leave at any time. And they have no more to do with you than they do with, than these travelers have together. So Narada Muni said, we have a dual existence. We're running this program externally where we have to carefully administer our duty in this ashram, and there's a lot to learn as one goes through the different ashrams and learns how to live in such a way to be Krishna conscious on one side. And that kind of detachment also doesn't mean that one becomes uncaring, cold, or distant from people. Actually, it can mean the opposite. It can mean actually having a more compassion, appreciation, that these are souls who have been put in my orbit for some time. But it's objective. And at the same time, externally, one should know that there are some needs of my relatives and family. And therefore, I shouldn't starve them emotionally, for instance, if I even if I understand my existential condition and theirs and my difference from them. So practically speaking, we go through different phases of life. We can't compare ourselves to Judd Bharat. I heard this morning Prabhupada speaking about, on the disappearance day of his sannyas guru, Bhakti Pragna Keshav Maharaj. And he was composing a letter of bereavement, of condolence, to be sent to the disciples and other godbrothers of Bhakti Pragna Keshav Maharaj. And Prabhupada wrote a formal letter, had all the devotees sign it. He signed it and he sent it to India. And in that, he was talking about how Bhakti Pragna Keshav Maharaj was his sannyas guru. And Prabhupada said that when he was a grihastha, his spiritual master was coming to him in dreams and saying, now you have to take sannyas. And Prabhupada said, I was horrified. He said, I didn't want to take sannyas. He said, how will I do that? I have my family. And he couldn't see it. And then Bhakti Pragnan Keshav Maharaj, who Prabhupada described as an ocean of mercy, he said, he forced me. He said, actually, my spiritual master forced me, but he worked through this godbrother and caused me to take sannyas. So I bring this up to recognize that at different phases of our life, we'll be in various situations in which we may not see how it is that we would be like Judd Bharat. And we're not to imitate, we're to follow in the footsteps and to do the best we can in whatever particular situation we're in now, apply it properly according to our qualification and our realization. And even as one goes through the various ashrams, say, as an example, the Grihastha ashram, there's so much to learn in that ashram. For instance, when we're relating to spouses, we have to simultaneously appreciate that we have a duty to perform to them according to our psychophysiological nature and theirs, and also we have a duty to them spiritually. Those two things, concepts, have to be held simultaneously. And The Sri Upanishad says, Vidyam cha vidyam cha yas tad vedo bayam saha avidya yam ratum tirtva vidya yam ratum ashunte. When you engage in culturing knowledge and nescience side by side, you see, you learn more. You actually learn more because they're juxtaposed. You see the difference more when they're side by side. So there's no impediment because of that. And we're enjoined to do our duty properly externally and internally. We have to constantly be reinforcing our spiritual position and understand it. A lot of that was philosophical. I don't know if any of it was helpful at all. Anyway, if I come up with more, I'll let you know. Anything else? Yes. Well, the verse says only one who can learn the process of nations and that are transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. Prabhupada's purport really says that you don't have to cultivate nations. It's already been done. So he says one should not live a one-sided existence, just be in nations. But you should also vigorously cultivate transcendental knowledge, and then it'll be there naturally side by side. How is it beneficial? Because as we're in the material world already, we're in a material body, and we're cultivating knowledge about how we're not the body, we have opportunities to look and see for ourselves. You can just check it out. As Prabhupada points out in one purport in the second canto of the Bhagavatam, says even an ordinary person, if they take time to introspect, can see that they're not their bodies. Even ordinary persons can do that. And he goes through an exercise where if you consider that the body's made of certain elements, and then you notice that those elements are there, and then you notice how your mind is moving and you're watching the movements, and then how intelligence comes to you. And the intelligence is being provided to you as a gift. It's not something that you are doing yourself, but it's coming to you as a revelation. You're being given gifts. You can begin to, step by step, look objectively and say, oh, I'm not my body. So you're in a situation where you can actually apply this transcendental knowledge and say, oh, it's very true. When I was in junior high school, they showed us a movie. I think it was about, I forget what the movie was about, but now I remember it in Christian conscious terms. I'm going to tell you what was in the movie, but I can't remember why they were showing it to us. But in any case, maybe it was about parasites. But they showed a handsome man and a beautiful woman getting ready to go out on a date. And they said, well, here's this very handsome man. Isn't he handsome? Yes, he is. And then, but what if we take a closer look? And then the camera goes closer, closer, and he has a mustache. And you go, what's in the mustache? And then it goes closer into the follicles of the hair. And then there's these little creatures that live in there. And they're like, how do you like him now? Like, everyone's going, ew. And then the woman's like, beautiful hair, right? Right. And then what if we take a closer look? And then what lives in the follicles of the hair? And there's these little, like, Martian creatures coming out. You're like, and so, you know, for a second there, everyone was observing the world in such a way that, God, I mean, this is a farce. It's a ruse. And this is what happens to people when they go to a funeral. It's called smashana vairagya, because they see their relative being burned by the fire, and then they suddenly think, oh, all this spiritual stuff is actually true, and all the other stuff is fake. And then after the funeral, a few days later, a few hours later, it wears off, and they willfully step back into the illusion. But we have the opportunity to cultivate transcendental knowledge. We're already in nescience. So now if we constantly cultivate transcendental knowledge every day, and we're able to compose it and juxtapose it, then we're able to actually get this solidified realization that I really don't have anything to do with this world. It's altogether possible for even an ordinary person to do. What to speak of someone who's been blessed with the desire to attain Krishna bhakti. So one can actually attain self-realization by this method, just by hearing and then applying it to one's own life and seeing that it's really true. Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
When I was thinking about the story, Bharat Maharaj was very advanced, and then he started having attachment to the deer. And then because of his advancement, in his next life he got the deer life, but he was still realized to some extent. And that made me think that, I mean, I have so many attachments right now. If I am able to get animal body, if I get animal body next life, and I don't get realization, then I may get stuck in that cycle again. So
what to do?
Yeah.
Well, Prabhupada tells in the story of Gajendra in the 8th canto, he gives this caveat. He said to all my disciples, if you fall down from the human life in your practice and you become an animal, see, in the context of Gajendra was a king in his previous life, Indradumna. And he learned some beautiful set of verses in glorifying the Lord. So then he got cursed by a sage, took birth as an elephant, forgot that he was a king until he was in deep trouble, and that was a crocodile grabbed onto his leg. And when he realized he was going to die, he called out to the Lord, and those verses came back into his mind from a previous life. So Prabhupada says, that's why he says, therefore my disciples should learn verses like the Brahma Samhita, the Nisringa Stotram, and other verses. You should memorize them. And he said, become perfect at chanting them. Because then, he said, even in your next life, you don't happen to make it as a, you know, to advancement to the next stage, then you'll be able to remember those. And Purva Samskara Samskrita. The Purva Samskars, they always come back. Sometimes people fall down from devotional life into animal life because they made some big offense. So then they spend one life as an animal, and then they come back, and they can make more advancement. Everything that's done in devotional service is permanent. You never lose it. Even if you happen to apparently slip, it'll come back in another time. It's never lost. So an intelligent person then says, why don't I have all loss and no gain? I just stay on a steady path to constantly increase my devotional service and not fall down. In fact, Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavatam, it's a regulative principle that one should not fall down from one's exalted position. Yes.
Very nice.
Oh, yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
So, very nice, several kind of reminders that you have given to all of us today in the narration of the story of the Dharmada and also the narration of Gajendra. So, when you were telling about Gajendra last time, right now, how he played out, and so then we have the remembrance, fortunately, you know, he could remember from maybe his past time. And so I was thinking, we may or may not have that. I don't know, we will make constant efforts consciously in this life, having all the teachings and all the associations and different reminders. And in spite of that, for some reason, for example, trying to save ourselves and our loved ones, for example, our children, if in our life, if we find that, for example, just a simple case, you know, closest case, children, we find that they may do something which may be an impediment for us also. So to what degree should we, go with it as kindness and loving support, affection, so that it's not an impediment for our progress?
Well, when you have dependents, they're not you, so they have their own will, so anything can happen. So you should know that when you take on dependents, whether they happen to be children or disciples or anything else. They have their own free will. So you can't expect that they'll do exactly as you tell them or as you teach. And there's destiny involved also. There's ways in which people are separated all the time. Things happen. So one always has to have that perspective that even though they are dependents, and it can be especially intense when they're children because I very much identify with them as being my children, but you have to understand that they can move on at any time. And also that one has to do one's due diligence with dependents to set an example and teach, but that it's not any guarantee, there's no guarantee that they're going to follow that. You see, Prabhupada is a pure devotee, and he had children that didn't take to Krishna consciousness. And he also had many disciples who vowed to follow his system, and many of them didn't. So what's he to do? And is he held at a lower standard because of that? Well, no, because that's the way dependents move when they have their own free choice. They can go in any direction that they like. So you have to be aware of that, even as we take on dependents, to see that we do our due diligence, we do the best that we can to help them, but we also have to see that they can go in any direction. And we're ultimately, you know, one will feel some bereavement because of that, but still, what can be done? The other point is that it's a long process. And as people learn in their own ways, sometimes children is an example. They may grow up with the benefit of being in Krishna consciousness, and then at a certain age, they may reject it. Because that sometimes is helpful to children to reject it. Because a lot of times children who grew up in Krishna consciousness aren't quite sure if they found it themselves or they decided on doing this for themselves or if it was bequeathed to them and that they give it up as a means to actually discover themselves. Stephen Covey talks about this in his book, Seven Habits of Highly Successful People, and he says that there's these three stages that people go through. One is called dependence, and the next one's called independence, and the third is called interdependence. So sometimes when somebody's overly dependent, then at some point they'll reject it to find themselves. And once they're independent and they find, oh, there was some great benefit to that, they go back on their own terms. And when that happens, then there's actually a solid connection. Otherwise, you may have dependents who are artificially following you for the wrong reason, and doing it, they're following for the wrong reasons. That's why I say artificial. But when they actually discover, I really want to do this, you'll notice the difference. Same thing when we go on Sankirtan, we present opportunity to people to take a book, for instance. I've always felt it's a nice practice to let them decide on their own. Because once they decide, using their own free will, whether they like to take it or not, although we do our best to persuade them, but there's a subtle way in which it's up to you. You do what you wish. They're living entities. They can actually decide, and they'll say, okay, I want to do this. And then it becomes very solid. In fact, sometimes in cases I've seen, I'll meet somebody, for instance, door to door. One comes to mind in Toronto, person, and I told them that, you know, we don't need the money, but if you give a donation, it's good for you, helps connect you to this penance, and connects you to the previous teachers and so forth. He had a little resistance. I said, that's okay. Absolutely no problem. You just keep it. Thank you very much. And you took your valuable time. And I really meant it. No subtle coercion or anything like that. I just cut him free and then walked away. And he came and searched me out 10 minutes later. He felt so compelled. Like, no, I want to give. This is for me. I want to give you this. And it was a very powerful experience. So you have to realize when we're dealing with other living entities that they have their own will to deal with, and we can encourage them every way, show by example and so forth, but then also respect the fact that they make their own choice. Ultimately, we can't force them. You're welcome. Oh, you go ahead, Akshin Mangal. 1, 2. Oh, good, you got 2 microphones. Very good. Okay, yeah. Prabhupada called it para avara. And he said the mind, it's neutral, but it can be engaged as an instrument, either as a means for it becoming more entangled in the material world or for our liberation. And so as we engage it in devotional practices, as Krishna puts it in the Bhagavad Gita, it becomes our friend. If we leave it untrained, and you only get one mind per customer in this world, and if you leave it untrained, I've seen... I knew somebody in Japan who had the habit of he'd collect dogs and then not train them. And there was one dog, I forget what his name was, but he was the most wild creature on earth because they didn't care to tell him anything. Like, you know, you shouldn't jump on people, you shouldn't slobber all over everything. And they just let him do whatever he wanted. And he grew up like that. And then he ended up being this Tasmanian wild dog, just crazy. I mean, he wasn't vicious or anything like that, but he would just jump all over everyone and everything. And I was thinking about how if you just let your mind go, as Krishna says, it remains unbridled, you don't give any training, then it'll just become unruly and it can do anything at any time. However, if you take the time to regulate your life and follow especially the instructions of Scripture of how to regulate. For instance, there's the admonition that you should regularly recite Scripture. This is mentioned in many places, but this is good for the human. Humans should get Scripture, and of all the Scriptures, Bhagavad Gita is really ideal for recitation because it's the summary of all the Vedas. Everything's there complete, spoken by Krishna. And if you just get in the regular habit of reciting Bhagavad Gita, then it will regulate your mind. It's almost like one of those little discs that you run. Well, they're not discs anymore, but a program that you run on your computer to get rid of all the bugs. Am I saying something correct? Get rid of all the bugs and to defragmentate the... Am I saying anything? Defrag the computer. It does something. You run it, it finds all these little mistakes, it closes all the gaps, and it's like, once you're done, it's like, okay, I'm ready to go again, I'm fast, you know, I know what I'm doing, I'm thinking. And when it gets messed up, they had all these adwares and malware, this ware, that ware, it gets in all the time. And you have to clean it out. And so if you recite Bhagavad Gita every day, it trains the mind in a certain way. Someone was telling me last night, they're reciting Bhagavad Gita every day, and then they're working. And then they remember, you were saying, and then you remember during the day, like, oh yeah, that verse just came into my mind. So that's important. It's also important to get up in the morning early and chant Hare Krishna. This is an important mantra. It's the names of God. And if you repeat it every day, you'll start to hear that sound vibration and the mind becomes attracted to it. In Japan, there's a lot of fishermen. They like to fish, especially when they're retired. Prabhupada talks about this in Nectar of Instruction. But in some cultures, they don't know what to do when they retire, so they go and they fish. It's a useless activity. Worse than useless, they're actually killing other living entities. But they, nonetheless, it's popular there. So I go for walks every day, and I'll walk by, you know, they have streams and little lakes and stuff even around the city because they landscape it. So these guys are sitting there with fish, and they just keep running it by the fish. I'll walk by, come back an hour later, still fishing. Sometimes they catch something. So I was thinking about how Japa is like that too. You really have to fish for your mind. Because on fish, fishermen get these lures. It's a shiny little object and it's got hooks all over it. It looks like a fish in the water when it goes through. So they throw it in and they pull it like this. And they keep doing it, and the fish keep looking at it, and then all of a sudden they just can't help themselves, and they go, "Gah, I got it," you know, and then they get trapped. So the same way, you got to keep running the mantra by your mind. You keep running it by like fishermen, and no, it didn't take it. They're so patient, those fishermen. They're out there all day. Boom, got it, you know. So with your japa, you have to sit there and keep running it by. Keep running this mantra by your mind. It's like, no, he didn't take it that time. He didn't take it again. Didn't take it again. And you keep going again. Boom, got it, you know. And then the mind gets caught on the mantra. And then you've got something. So you have to be a little patient like that. These are bona fide processes for actually controlling the mind. Recite Bhagavad Gita. Chant the mantra until you catch your mind on it. And it gets some kind of taste for the mantra. It gets caught. And then there's services that you can do, like cooking. One of the nicest services that you can do for Krishna is to cook. And when you're cooking, you think of how you're going to offer it to Krishna and how he'll accept it and he'll taste it. And very practical too, because after you're done cooking, then you can arrange everything on a plate. You take a tulsi leaf from a plant that you grow in your house, which is something that engages all the senses. You even have to call people on the phone. Let's get these little spider webs. What do I do about that? This is a practical life situation. And then you take one tulsi leaf and you put it on the plate along with the prasadam, and it's, you're thinking like, wow, this is for a person. And this is very specific. He likes tulsi on the plate or he won't take it. And then you take the plate, you put it on the altar, you ring the bell, you say the prayers, you say, Krishna, please accept this. And this engages the mind. It's very practical. Otherwise, you can just come home and grab a bag of Cheetos and jam your hand into it and stuff them in your mouth as fast as you can. And a half gallon of ice cream and a spoon. And there's no real no real consciousness there, except for animalistic. Was there someone else? Yes. One, two. You were too? Okay, go ahead. Yes.
Maharaj, you said focus on bhakti, you need just greed. You don't need, somebody may be very pious, but it may take many, many years. So if you can just explain how.
Well, this is referring to materially based pious activities don't lead to devotional service. Only bhakti comes from bhakti. So you only get bhakti from those who have bhakti. It comes from the hearts of devotees, really. Yudhishthira Maharaj said it to Vidura, Bhavadvidha Bhagavatas Tirtha Bhuta Svayam Vibho Tirtha Kurvanti Tirthani Swantasthena Gataprita. He said, you're a walking pilgrimage place because wherever you go, you carry Krishna within your heart, and therefore you give him to other people wherever you go. And bhakti is something that is bhakti means love for Krishna, our original love for Krishna. And so all the activities that we do, even in our practice, are meant to stimulate that love. We're meant to reawaken that spontaneous love for Krishna. And if you have an intense desire, if you can develop the intense desire for bhakti, this is a sign of the awakening of that spontaneous love, because it's already there. So there are many examples given by Rupa Goswami and other Vaishnava poets who compare the way that we become madly attached to people and objects in the material world. They compare that to this intensity of bhakti. For instance, young boys and young girls don't need to be instructed to be attracted to one another. Correct? Say yes.
Yes.
Yes. In fact, I heard about a busload of kids they took to the Grand Canyon, and they were so engaged in talking to one another, after they got off the bus, they didn't even notice they were there. I said, by the way, there's a Grand Canyon. Oh! They're so distracted. Because it's natural, the minds of young boys, young girls, they become attracted. So Rupa Goswami says that just in that same way, let my mind be spontaneously attracted to you, Krishna. And that's the intensity of that kind of love for God. When it's properly focused, then this becomes tivrena bhakti yogina, becomes very like a sun ray. When you concentrate it, it can start a fire. So you have to have that concentrated desire. Not mixed with all kinds of other desires. You're not doing it for any other reason, and it's spontaneous and very intense. You can't really learn how to love. Love is already there. You can simply uncover that love. And the symptom of it being uncovered is that intense desire. It starts to awaken in various stages that can be identified. And one of those stages technically is called lalyam. That starts to happen after one attains nishta. And nishta means the absence of all the limiting factors in my devotional practice, some of which are identified as loya, which means sleep. It means when I start to hear, I become sleepy. If someone tells me I won the lottery, I'll wake right up. Or if someone tells me there's World Cup. What's the World Cup? Is it soccer or is it cricket? Someone says World Cup and it's Pakistan against India, I'll wake up. But if someone said, let's read Bhagavatam, I go to sleep. So this is called laya. I'm not interested. Vishepa means that I become distracted easily. I'm doing my bhajan, I'm chanting or I'm hearing, but then my mind's easily distracted. It's like someone in my mind brings up, hey, why don't you check the weather? It's like, yeah, why didn't I think of that? I should check the weather instead of chanting. And off I go. Or whatever it is, the mind becomes distracted. And a pratipati means that there's no distractions and you're not sleepy, but you just don't care. And that's another kind of anarta within the heart. And then there is certain kinds of leftover things like anger or lust that are naturally there within the heart that come out at different intervals. And then there are the senses attracted to their objects just spontaneously. So these are listed as the blockades to nishta. Between anartha nivritti and actually becoming steady in devotional service, which is defined as the absence of those things. When those things are no longer there, in other words, you will notice for yourself that you're actually interested in hearing and you don't want to go to sleep. You don't even feel like it. And you'll also not be distracted by other things. You could be listening, and you're so intensely listening that a monkey outside, you know, can break the tree down, and, you know, you just, like, I'm not going to deviate my mind. I'm going to keep listening because you're so interested in it. So you can notice that. That's called nishta. And just after nishta, the one that actually starts to develop this intensity, the intensity of the desire to hear about Krishna thickens. And then it starts to be called lalyam or greed. So one becomes greedy to hear about Krishna. Like you'll cut other people off just to get there if you're driving somewhere and you're greedy. So it's like, whatever it takes, I'm getting there, I'm going to be there. I don't care what anybody says. You know, you got to have it. So it's an addiction. Just like any other addiction in the material world, only this is an addiction on the positive side. Was there one or two more? Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Just a short question. So you mentioned about lalyam. So that is the high stage of feeling greedy about your devotional life towards the heart. But in that case, how do we really associate with devotees if we are really greedy and greedy in our devotional service? Because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has said, like, association is really important.
Well, that's part of fulfilling that greed, is to associate with like-minded devotees. It's like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he associated with Ramananda Roy, and Ramananda Roy and who else am I? And huh? Sarvam. No, and Swarup Damodar, especially in his final days. He was exhibiting the highest kind of greed, but, you know, he associated with those who were on the same level. So Lord Chaitanya taught Sanatana Goswami that even in these higher stages, it doesn't mean that we dissociate ourselves. No, we become more connected to devotees. But especially in those cases, we become interested in like-minded devotees who have a similar kind of desire. So we'll become attentive to that. And it also includes greed for service, greed for serving Krishna in all different ways. In fact, these different levels of attachment to Krishna. It is mentioned in Madhurya Kadambini that devotees who there's two levels of attachment to the holy name. One level, devotees really desire to hear kirtan and hear the holy name, but they only like it when it's really nicely done. Like, I only like these kirtan leaders. But the higher level is they don't care who's singing it, as long as they're devotees. It doesn't, they can be off pitch or whatever. It's not like some musical arrangement or anything like that. It's just like, it's the holy name. They have this taste for it. In any case, those with greed act in all phases of their life. All their different services are exhibited by an intense attachment for serving Krishna in various ways. And this really comes out. Ultimately, one's advancement is shown. Madhvacharya says this in his commentary to the very famous verse that says, the verse that Srila Ishvarapuri gave to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu upon his initiation. Evam vrta sva priya nama kirtya chitana rago jita chuta uchar hasatyato rautiti rauti gayati unmadavan vrittiti lokabhayaha. This verse in the Bhagavatam says that when a person advances in devotional service, in chanting the holy name, evam vrata, he makes a vrat, a vow, a serious vow to chant Hare Krishna, para swaparam, then his heart begins to melt at a certain point. And then becomes deeply attached to the holy name. And then he starts to act in erratic ways, dancing in public for no reason, apparently, like a madman. But he doesn't care for outsiders. He doesn't even notice. So in the commentary, Madhvacharya says that some devotees show these kind of external symptoms and others don't. But he said that all advanced Vaishnavas show two symptoms of advancement which are verifiable. But we've run out of time, so I can't tell you what they are. I just want to see if you have any lolium. So one of them is steadiness. Steadiness means that the person's always there, always shows up for the service. Neophyte devotees, they can do service for a while and then they give it up. They'll say, I can't do it anymore. And they'll have a whole list of excuses they found somewhere by the side of the road. And it's like, here, I found this list of excuses why I can't do my service anymore. And then, so that's one. They're just steady. You don't even have to say anything if you're steady. And especially, some people can be steady for 3 years, or even 7 years. But if somebody's steady for 20 years, and you start looking at 30 or 40 or 50 years of steadiness, then you start to see, the person's got a portfolio in devotional service. So the steadiness is very important. And the other point he said is called mukhya prasadad, and that means the words, the sound that comes from that person's mouth is merciful. You can trace it back and you see the reason they spoke was not impulsive. It wasn't out of greed, it wasn't out of lust, it wasn't out of anger, but it was out of mercifulness, the reason they're speaking. And you can discern that their speech is different. So Madhvacharya says, these two are verifiable ways of understanding who is an advanced devotee, what their internal state is. Because other people can fake doing ecstatic symptoms. There are a whole class of people who do that. They practice crying and rolling on the ground and doing all these. But they may just actually be faking it. But you can't fake steadiness, because you either show up or you don't. And ultimately, Prabhupada said, a fool is discovered when he or she speaks, because you speak what's in your mind and heart ultimately, so you can judge by that too. Is it? Yes, Nirkula? Sharing means caring. Salvation Army says that. Okay? You want to hear one more verse?
Yes.
Yes? Text number 11. The physical elements, nature, the original cause, culture, destiny, and the time element are all material causes. Agitated by these material causes, the 11 functions transform into hundreds of functions and then into thousands and then into millions. But all these transformations do not take place automatically by mutual combination. Rather, they are under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purport. One should not think that all the interactions of the physical elements, gross and subtle, that cause the transformation of mind and consciousness are working independently. They are under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Krishna says that the Lord is situated in everyone's heart. Sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto matak smitir gyanam apohanam cha. As mentioned herein, Supersoul, Kshetrajna, is directing everything. The living entity is also Kshetrajna, but the Supreme Kshetrajna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is the witness and order giver. Under his direction, everything takes place. The different inclinations of the living entity are created by his own nature or his expectations, and he is trained by the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the agency of material nature. The body, nature, and physical elements are under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They do not function automatically. Nature is neither independent nor automatic. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is behind nature. Mayadyakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam hetunane na kaunteya jagadviparivartate. This material nature is working under my direction, O Son of Kunti, and it is producing all moving and unmoving beings. By its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilate it again and again. Text number 12. The individual soul, bereft of Krishna consciousness, has many ideas and activities created in the mind by external energy. They have been existing since from time immemorial. Sometimes they are manifest in the awakening state and in the dream state, but during deep sleep, unconsciousness, or trance, they disappear. A person who is liberated in this life, Jivan Mukta, can see all these things vividly. Purport. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 13.3, Kshetrajnam chapimam vidhi sarva-kshetri shubharata. There are two kinds of kshetra, or living beings. One is the individual living being, and the other is the supreme living being. The ordinary living being knows about his body to some extent, but the supreme Paramatma knows the condition of all bodies. The individual living being is localized, and the Supreme Paramatma is all-pervading. In this shloka, the word Kshetrajna refers to an ordinary living being, not the Supreme Living Being. This ordinary living being is of two kinds, Nityabuddha and Nityamukta. One is eternally conditioned, and the other eternally liberated. The eternally liberated living beings are in the Vaikuntha Jagat, the spiritual world, and they never fall into the material world. Those in the material world are conditioned souls, Nityabuddha. The Nityabuddhas can become liberated by controlling the mind because the cause of conditioned life is the mind. What's the cause of conditioned life?
Mind.
Correct. When the mind is trained and the soul is not under the mind's control, the soul can be liberated even in this material world. When it is liberated, when it is liberated, one is called Jivan Mukta. What's one called when one's liberated? A Jivan Mukta knows how he has become conditioned. Therefore, he tries to purify himself and return home back to Godhead. The eternally conditioned soul is eternally conditioned because he is controlled by the mind. The conditioned state and liberated state are compared to the sleeping, unconscious state and the awakened state. Those who are sleeping and unconscious are eternally conditioned, but those who are awake understand that they are eternally part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna. Therefore, even in this material world, they engage in Krishna's service. As confirmed by Srila Rupa Goswami, Iha yasya harer dasye, if one takes to Krishna's service, he is liberated, even though he appears to be a conditioned soul within the material world. Jivan mukta su ujite, in any condition, one is to be considered liberated if his only business is to serve Krishna. So the body and all its elements are material, and we're spiritual within the body. But if we get good direction and we engage the subtle and gross body, which is material, in just Krishna's service, then it transforms into spiritual energy. And what was a material body then is no longer. It becomes, instead of a material body, becomes a sadaka deha, or a practitioner's body. And Prabhupada gives the example in many places of an iron rod that's placed in fire. Iron can become transformed. How is it transformed? By contact with fire. So the iron rod in contact with fire becomes hotter and hotter, and then it becomes red hot, and then you can't distinguish between the iron and the fire. It's one and the same. So in a similar way, when the mind and all of our senses, the body's made of senses, are engaged in the service of Krishna, they transform also, and they become spiritual. In the Gita, Krishna says, Brahmarpanam brahmahavir brahmagnau brahmanohutam brahmaiva tena gantavyam brahmakarma samadhina. He gives the example that in a fire yajna, there's a spoon, there's the person who's offering, there's the ghee, there's the little pot, the fire, and because everything in the arena of the fire sacrifice is meant to please Yajneshwara, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's all engaged in service. Although they may appear to be material elements superficially, they are transformed into Brahman. They become spiritual. So Prabhupada speaks in his purport about how everything that we have in our lives is transformable when it's engaged in Krishna service. And that includes the mind. It's engaged in Krishna service and it becomes para, or superior energy. Any question? Yeah.
We learn that mind is the cause of suffering. That's very important, as you mentioned, so that we can diagnose our problem. I had a question that mind actually is so smart, it has so many techniques and different ways. Seems to be ahead of us in the race many a times. But in your, so my question was, how do we not fall prey to our mind? Not just in certain special cases, but because so it has so many new tricks all the time. But a couple of points that you mentioned came to me as answers. One you said...
Well, don't answer it because then I'll have no job.
No, I want to...
Okay, go ahead.
More tips from you.
I'll just relax and have a drink. No, go ahead.
One thing you mentioned is doing japa, constantly chanting, fishing the mind.
Yeah.
Another also came to me, but skip the mind now.
You're just doing that to be nice. Okay, well, there's a way in which in any occupation you have to become more and more expert. And when you become more expert, you get into the details that others may not know anything about. And you can do what seems to be magic because you know the science. For instance, in gardening, I've dabbled in gardening for many years. But when I actually watch a real gardener who lives in the soil all the time, you can see it. I mean, their clothes are all geared for living in the garden. and their fingers look like gardener's fingers. They know stuff that I don't know. For one thing, I remember when I was first putting my garden in, we were deciding which plants to put in everything, but we had a problem with some kind of what we call a weed, but it was crabgrass, and it's very invasive. It has a way of growing underground, and it splits off, so it can multiply really rapidly, and it can end up going all over your garden. And you work at it for a while, you take out the crabgrass, and then you think, I got it, and then you come back from your vacation, or whatever it is, and you notice that it's all back again. So I was asking my gardener, I said, so it's impossible to get rid of? And he said, not impossible. You just have to try harder. And he said, you can eradicate any weed, but you have to be meticulous. And you really have to go after it. And I said, yeah, let's see it. And then I realized I was just lazy about doing it because I didn't have confidence that it could be done. But when I watched he and his wife, who was also a gardener, go after the crabgrass, they were getting down to the tiniest little pieces they were taking out. And they would leave no piece behind. He said, see that little piece? That'll come back. And they did it. And we haven't seen it for years now. They actually eradicated it. And in a similar way, with you said there's new tricks and unlimited ways the mind may come up with it. Actually, they're not unlimited. They're categories. And they're listed, for instance, by Raghunath Das Goswami in the Manakshiksha, the prayers to the mind. And he categorizes them all because he's an expert gardener. He's teaching us, here's the different ways that the false ego is going to come at you. And this is the different ways that you eradicate. So you can it can be eradicated. But you have to follow an expert gardener. You have to read the book very carefully or work side by side with a gardener and learn the technique for the eradication. You have to learn the different kinds of weeds. My gardener also showed us another kind of weed that comes up in the spring, and you have to get it early because it has little explosive buds on it. You have these out here? It's really funny, actually. If you wait too long, you don't get it when it's young. Those little explosive seed pods on the top, as soon as you touch it, they explode, and they shoot all over the yard. I mean, it can from this tiny little plant, it can shoot it from here to the front door. Pow, they just explode. And that's how they survive. But he said you can eradicate that too, but you have to be there a month before the pods are ready to explode. So you have to know what you're doing. So through expert guidance and through diligence, one can actually come to the end of these anartas. It's not impossible, but it has to be done. And that's why the acharyas leave behind guidebooks like the Nectar of Instruction, where he gives it a very simplified form. He said, here's six things that'll sink you. Here's six things that'll bring you up to the top. That makes it simple. You just look at these different categories. Like atyahara. Atyahara means extreme eating. Living to eat. Or collect things. Shopping. Or whatever it is. Atyahara. And then, you know, he tells like why this is bad for you. And you can take a whole broad category and work on that category, and it can be done. And Prabhupada gives in his purports a lot of explication of how to do that, how to live in such a way that you can avoid that. So be meticulous and be patient and take good guidance. And it looks like our time has run out. So we'll have just... Right, Loka?
Yeah, okay.
Do you have more questions? You do?
So, do we need Krishna grace also to control our mind?
Yes. You have to have Krishna's grace to control your mind. Even being able to do devotional service in the first place comes through the grace of Vaishnavas and Krishna. Like chanting japa, you notice people all the time, they'll say, you know, I can't chant. I just can't do it. I can only do one round a day. And they'll say that for years. Every time I see them, they'll say, I can only do one round. And then you know, they keep coming, listening to classes, coming to the artiques, taking prasadam, getting association devotees. And then I'll run into them at a Sunday program, how you doing? I'm chanting 16 rounds, I can't believe it. And it happens so many times because it's an empowered activity. To be able to do anything is empowered. In fact, we heard that Krishna is arranging our material life for us. This is brought up in this last purport. Whatever facility we have for our material life, it's Krishna's arrangement. He's controlling the material nature. In the first canto of Bhagavatam, asau gunamayar bhavir bhuta sukshmendriya mabhi sa nirmiteshu nirvishto bhunte bhuteshu tadgurar. At the beginning of creation, the Lord enters within the hearts of all the created beings, and he reminds them of their previous desires. And then he provides all the facility for them to pursue those desires, because that's what they want. And so if one decides one wants devotional service, and this is the real trick, you have to decide. If you decide by good association, by hearing Sambandha Gyan, about your relationship with Krishna, you actually come to this inner decision that I want Krishna, I don't want anything else. Even if at that time you can't perform all the duties, and you can't do it perfectly, that's not so important. The important thing is you made the decision. It's there in your heart, and you say, I'm doing this, I don't care what anybody else says, and this is my main objective in life. And I'm going to surrender to Krishna whatever way I can, even though I'm imperfectly doing it, even though I'm situated in the worst possible way right now. You've made the decision. Then Krishna will help you enact that decision in your life. And that's why in the Gita he says, Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam tadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam upayantite. If my devotee has a sincere desire in his or her heart to advance in devotional service, then I'll give all intelligence how to do it. What to speak of facility. And how is it that somebody suddenly meets a devotee, or we heard thousands of stories of people who are sitting praying and then all of a sudden, excuse me, sir, take this, you know, like, what is it? This is a ticket back to Godhead. Well, thank you very much. Where did you come from? Somebody told me to get off here and walk over here, and that's what I did. Krishna's arranging all these things. So yes, it comes by Krishna's mercy. And in the story of Yashoda chasing after Krishna, we find that she couldn't tie him up. 2 inches too short every time, no matter how much rope she added on. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, those 2 inches are significant. 1 inch represents our own endeavor. Because you'll notice in the story, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, Yashoda tried until she was perspiring. And then Krishna noticed that, she's working hard. I'll help her do it. And then he covered the second inch. So he said, that's important. We have to try. The Prabhupada says, Krishna instructed Arjuna at the battle of, during the battle of Kurukshetra, just before it began, about what to do. But he said, then he didn't tell Arjuna, now you sit down on the chariot and smoke ganja, and I'll fight the battle. He said, you fight. So you have to, Krishna's mercy is there, but we have to express our own desire. We actually have to decide, because we're independent living entities, or individual living entities. We're not independent, but we're individual. And if we make that decision, then Krishna will move heaven and earth. As much as he's moved heaven and earth to make a whole fake material world for us to try to enjoy, he'll make a whole spiritual world. He'll give us all facility for the spiritual world. So it's his mercy, ultimately. We just desire. Yes.
This difference between matter and spirit, and using this example of iron and fire, and then matter becoming spirit. So the discussion was that what does it really mean for matter to become spirit? Because is it in terms of the impact it has? Because we see our temples or anything like a microphone. The difference between matter and spirit is matter is temporary and spirit is eternal, and matter is doesn't have consciousness and spirit has consciousness. So we don't really see matter transforming into spirit in that way. So does it mean that it has an impact on those that come in touch with it and they get purified? Or what does it really mean?
It's easier to conceive of it in terms of consciousness. As a verse in the Bhagavatam Krishna gives to Brahma as in part of the Chatur Shloki, Ratertam yat pratyeta na pratyeta chatmani tadvidyaratmano mayam yathabhaso yathatamaha. He said that anything that you see that you don't relate to me, that's illusion. That's separated. Now it's separated because it's not in connection with me. So it's separated by consciousness. Matter doesn't matter until a conscious living being looks at it and says, this matters. And matter doesn't have any particular designation until I designate it as a conscious living being. So then it changes from being a glass to my glass. My grandmother gave me that glass. That's my glass. It's just a piece of glass. And if it's just a piece of glass and it breaks somewhere, I don't even care. But if it's mine, because my grandmother gave it to me, then I really care. So I invest my consciousness in this, even though it's matter. Now it becomes something that's connected to me, but by consciousness. And in a similar way, anything that we connect to Krishna in his service becomes transcendentalized. And everything has a connection to Krishna. The whole material world is his energy. That's why Prahlad Maharaj in his prayers says, everything you think, everything that you see, all the money that comes to you from your boss, the job that you have that you thought you got on your own, that's all me. It's my energy, so it's non-different from me. He says, a devotee sees everything in relationship to Krishna, therefore sees it in the proper way and it becomes transcendental because that's its natural state. It's connected to Krishna. But when I forget and I don't see any connection, then it becomes Maya. So Prabhupada gives the other designation between the internal and the external potency. So or separated energy. He said, just like a tape recorder, he said, I'm speaking now, and my same voice will be replicated at another time. And he said, the same voice, but still I'm not speaking. So Krishna has his energies that expand, so it's Krishna, but they have different function, and they're separated from him.
So the intrinsic quality of matter is not going to change, but it's the fact that it now gets connected back to Krishna through consciousness.
Well, you used the word change, but earlier I emphasized the word transform, but it is transformable. And the proof is that there are elements that we can see even in the material world, so-called material world, they're transformable. For instance, iron can become fire. So all the elements are transformable by consciousness. Matter can turn into spirit by consciousness, by conscious connection to Krishna. It's all Krishna's energy, so he can manipulate it in any way that he wishes. In a very practical way, and that's very philosophical, but one can see in a practical way how those things that are engaged in Krishna's service become transformed, and one can experience it for oneself. And one can also see that those things that are not connected to Krishna become a great burden on my life, and they cause great anxiety, whereas those things that I connect to Krishna are the cause of my liberation. You can just see the effect that they have on us in the way that we connect them to consciousness. But, you know, talking about what's real and what's not real, what has form, what doesn't have form, if you go through the Bhagavatam, you'll find out how the whole material world is assembled one piece after another. And how it becomes dissembled at the end, non-application of the conglomerating process. There's a conglomerating process that happens, that's described in the Bhagavatam, how one element expands from another, and they all come from sound originally, in touch with the false ego. And then from there, there the different elements expand, and the different senses expand too, from sound, then the subtle sense of the ear becomes expanded, and then the gross manifestation of the ear is there. And all these things come from the universal form of the Lord, and the whole purpose of the material world is to give living entities an opportunity to either enjoy their senses or to become liberated. So it's a matter of choice whether it's utilized for material cause or for spiritual cause, and then it becomes dissembled and it assumes its real identity as being a part of Krishna. Even the senses are manifest from the original universal form of the Lord. The senses that we have are part and parcel. Just as we're part and parcel of Krishna, all the senses that we have originally emanate from the Purusha within the universe. So nothing's disconnected, just my consciousness becomes disconnected from Krishna. I think that I'm independent. This is what I just, even in physics, there's this struggle to understand the difference between what's solid and what's not solid, what exists and what doesn't exist. So Bhagavatam also goes into great detail about the subtle sense is there, and then the gross sense manifests around it. In the subtle sense, when it's tinged by false ego, contaminated by false ego, then becomes separated from Krishna. But when we assume our real ego, then what is the question of something being material? Everything can be engaged in Krishna's service. That's why Prabodhananda Saraswati sees the entire world as the material world as the abode of joy. How is that when Krishna describes it as dukalayam, ashashvatam? So he's seeing a relationship with Krishna. So, having said that, now is time for Loka to invite us to come out to do Sankirtan.
Gopremanande Ditai Gora Haribo 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 Ditai Gora Haribo Ditai Gora Haribo Bo Haribo Ditai Gora Haribo
Marman Natari Marman Natari Marman, Natari Marman, hey, Natari Marman, Natari Marman, Natari Marman, Natari Marman.